Welcome, everyone, to the podcast Sociology Matters. I'm Marianne Paiva. I'm a researcher, a teacher, an advocate. For nearly 20 years, I've been teaching sociology at the college level. I love teaching, and I love seeing the light bulb click on in a student's eyes when they suddenly get a concept we discuss in class. I love it. But recently, we've had to change everything we know about face-to-face teaching and go completely online. This episode focuses on a class that I teach called Public Sociology. In fall 2020, we're studying the sociology of natural disasters. Today, I want to bring you some special guests, which really only could be accomplished through a podcast. Normally, I would invite these people into class, or I would have them call in or Zoom in for us. They're living in a bit of a precarious situation where internet and phone isn't necessarily stable. So I wanted to bring them to you on the podcast today. You're going to meet two very special people who I've known for over a year now. Both Terry Rubiolo and Cheryl Lee Harrell are campfire survivors. They live in Concow, California, and have been back up in the burn scar since just a few weeks and months after the fire. In the class, we've been focusing on food and housing insecurity after disasters, and so I wanted to ask Terry and Cheryl Lee how they've accessed food and housing in the time since the fire, and especially 2 years after the fire now, how they're getting their basic needs met. First, we're going to talk to Terry. Terry is a woman who lives up in Concow. She's been a Concow resident for more than 20 years. 5 years ago, she and her husband, John, started a hot meal service for local people in need. Before the fire, John and Terry were serving 20 to 30 people on any given night. The number of people John and Terry serve every day and every week varies. In the first weeks and months after the fire, they were serving between 50 and 70 people a day. Either people would come to their donation site where they would pick up dry food, they would pick up clothes, boots, supplies that they needed to start the rebuilding and recovery process, and they also would pick up hot meals. 3 days a week, Terry and John deliver meals all over the mountain. They are delivering about 50 meals Monday, Wednesday, Friday to people who can't get to them, either because they don't have a car, they don't have gas, they are living with disabilities, or they're just in very remote areas. 6 days a week, Sunday through Friday, they serve hot meals out of their home, which is actually a travel trailer on the site of their former home, which was burned in 2018 in the campfire. Terry joins us today, and I'm so thankful that she's here today to talk to us about what she's seeing on the mountain, how people are recovering in Concow, Yankee Hill, and Big Bend, which are all very rural, unincorporated areas just to the south of Paradise. The fire came to Concow first, and by about 7:15 on the morning of the fire, Terry and John were running for their lives. So today, Terry's going to talk to us a little bit about food insecurity and housing insecurity. So please help me welcome Terry Rubiolo.
So I'm really interested to know, I know you've been cooking for your community for about 5 years now, and then 2 years specifically for campfire survivors, and now the bear fire survivors. And so, I'm just wondering what you're seeing now in the community and kind of how many people you're serving and what the needs for housing and food are for people.
It's a struggle because a lot of people are now living in trailers that used to be in houses, and a lot of them are seniors, which puts a whole different stress on health and that kind of stuff. And then families trying to have 4 or 5 kids in a 26-foot space, it's hard. And we really don't see a light at the end of the tunnel because of a couple of reasons. The first one just being that PG&E is going to break payments up. And when you hear the rest of what I'm saying, it'll make a little sense. But basically what's going to happen is everybody's going to play catch up, stock up, and not have anything left. And there's not enough to get loans. There's not enough for a lot of people to make a new start. They're just doing everything they can to survive. And so it makes it really hard on the housing because there's extra expenses of propane to keep it warm if you're lucky enough to have a heater that works. Paying for septic dumps, having water brought in. There's a lot of added expenses in a trailer that you didn't have in a house. And then that takes us over to the food end of things, which everybody gets used to having a refrigerator that's normal size. We can hold about a quarter food-wise in the refrigerators that are working in trailers, which means instead of being able to get a week's worth of food or more, we have to plan on every 2 to 3 days. And that eats up the gas funds unless they shop locally, which is, they might as well go to town and get more food. But I'm grateful the store's there, but they're really expensive. And so people are using the donation centers and stuff to literally survive, not so much just supplement anymore, because there's just not the funds available to try and live a normal life like people did when they had houses.
What kind of people are you seeing? Do you see a trend in kind of the type of people, like people without insurance or people who are older, you know, maybe young families who are still in temporary housing like trailers more than others?
I have it from beginning to end. There's the young families to the seniors. That one's really hard because I was doing this before the fire, and we had a lot of just widespread. Most are low income. Most of them didn't have insurance. A lot of them have been struggling for a long time, and this just has made it worse. They're not back to where they were. Some are, but most of them aren't even back to where they were because of added expenses and lifestyle and this, and just being limited so drastically. I'm seeing a lot more of the seniors that need help now to get by, that were making it okay. I mean, none of us were rich up here, but they were able to take care of themselves and their own. And we're helping a lot more of the seniors, all age brackets.
So I know that you are helping some seniors who have physical limitations. Is it, you know, more than you maybe would before? Is trying to cook in a trailer with physical limitations different than what kind of barriers are you seeing that are kind of living in a trailer, cooking in a trailer, does that bring up?
Okay. Well, me versus somebody else, I've been spoiled. I was given a trailer kitchen, which is separate from my home. But what I've been seeing with a lot of the people that we actually go in and help hands-on, you know, whether it's trying to organize their trailer a little better for them, whatever, is that they don't have the space to put stuff up, so things stack up, so they can't really keep clean. There's things stacked on the stove. It's harder for them because a lot of times they can't reach the very limited cabinets and stuff that are in a trailer to be able to put things away. And so they end up, you know, it's like anybody else, a normal room. You start letting things, you have a junk room or a junk drawer. Things just keep spilling into it until you go back to the drawer below it. There's a junk drawer now. And it's kind of like that in living in a trailer for especially our people with handicaps. Because the accessibility of the space needed isn't there, so they will put their paperwork here, and they'll put their pots and pans on top of that. And so things get lost real easy because they just can't do it. It's hard living in a trailer.
How many people are you serving hot meals to every week?
Between 300 and 400 dinners.
Hot dinners a week?
Yes.
Wow.
Hot dinners only. That's not the need center or anything like that. That's just right. The meals I cook and send out.
And how many people are you delivering to?
That's going up and down quite a bit. 6, 12,
19, 42. Why can't people get to you? Why are you delivering?
The ones we're delivering to are 98% of them. Have no vehicle or don't have licenses. You know, our seniors, again, one of my ladies has had a stroke and hasn't been able to drive for years. She doesn't have family close by to get her here. I mean, she's just one, but we've got one that has cancer and can't come out. We have a few that just got added that are, they're seniors and they're afraid to come out because of COVID and stuff like that. All of them have either a medical or a reason that they cannot get here.
Some reason. So either no car, no access to car, or physical limitations.
Yes.
So you say you don't see a light at the end of the tunnel. Is this your long-term mission?
Yes. We're looking at, even after people, let's say a miracle happens and houses get built and then life goes back to how it was, there's always been people that have trouble making it. And mm-hmm. so that's why we started doing it, and that's why we'll continue doing it. What we can kind of figure, we're kind of ballparking just with what we see and the people talking and stuff and knowing what's going on because we're going through it ourselves, that for the majority of people, we're looking at least 10 years before life actually gets back to semi-normal here.
If it's going to take that long, why don't people leave?
It's home. You wouldn't leave home. You'd find a way to make it work. And so they have us, and we have people helping us so that we can help them. I don't know how to explain that one. I mean,
yeah. Well, these are people that have lived up there for decades, right? Most of them.
Yeah, most of them, actually, not just them, but, you know, their grandparents built the houses that burned down. You know, so there's a lot of history. It's not just they came up here, you know, a couple years ago and lost everything. I mean, Concow and Yankee Hill and Big Bend are family. Most of them are owned by families that's been passed down through the generations. This is where they grew up. This is where their hearts are. You just walk away because it's hard. And right now, no matter where you go, it's going to be hard because we don't have anything to go with.
Right.
I mean, when you put your heart and soul into something and all your friends and family are here, most of the people that stayed are family units, from grandparents to great-grandchildren. Still, they all came back. You own what you have and you love what you have and you try to put it back together. Mm-hmm. It's just the way that things are working out, it's going to be long-term because, like the settlement from PG&E, it's not a lump sum where people can go, okay, I can rebuild now. Or I've got most of it so they can qualify for a loan to finish it. And so that's really putting a setback in everybody.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so you were talking about PG&E, about they're doing these kind of bits and pieces settlements instead of one big lump sum.
Yeah.
And so I imagine it's going to work where people are going to be like, okay, I got $10,000. I'm going to pay off my bills. I'm going to kind of get ahead. And then there's nothing left to rebuild with.
Exactly. Okay, let's use an example. They're talking about up to $25,000. Let's say everybody gets the $25,000. Everybody knows they're not going to be able to rebuild. So what's going to happen is they'll stash a little bit, but they're going to run out to the store and they're going to spend $1,000 on nothing because it's something. And that's what's going to happen with every little bit. Every time they send out a small little amount to us, you know, the majority of the people are going to go, okay, my kids need new shoes and clothes, you know, I mean, and, you know, we got to make sure that we've got some backup food, you know, out there in the shed, because don't know if we go to the store and the shows are, you know what I'm saying? It's
right.
So different things going on right now. And it really is going to make a difference as to whether people build or rebuild or not because of the way they're doing it.
Right.
You know, my husband and I were on a fixed income. We get enough that we could qualify for a small loan, not enough to build a house. But if PG&E paid me $200,000 off of the $600,000 that we lost, I would have that to go to a bank and say, here's $200,000. Can we borrow $150,000 and get a house built?
Right.
But I can go to the bank and say, they paid me $25,000. I know there's more coming. I don't know how much more can I get a loan to build a house. They're going to say no.
Right. Right.
And so this is why I can see it being long term, And what's going to happen during that time, my opinion, is that that money that they're going to get, some will find a way to rebuild. Others are just going to spend it as they go, but they're also going to adjust to the living and what they can do. And at some point, county's going to make it impossible for them to be there anyway. They'll have to take some of that money, go get an apartment, whatever. But that's still not going to be immediate. They're going to string this along because the county is getting a lot of funds off of people trying to get permits to do something as simple as put in a power pole so they don't have to run a generator. There's a lot of different things that are going to go into feeding this. And so that's why we figure 8 to 10 years of the bigger amount of people needing help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after that time, we'll go back to doing probably what we did because the need will be less and different. You know, we'll go back to the 30 to 50 people that would come and sit down at our table and eat.
Yeah.
And I know that Alyssa Nolan is helping with tiny houses.
Yes.
Is that, how's that going for her? How's that? I know she's been helping the Concow community. Is that just a drop in the bucket?
Oh, you know it. And she's been awesome. I absolutely adore that lady. But when it takes 3 months to do one tiny house, that's 4 families a year.
Right. It's interesting because the news has been, you know, saying, oh my goodness, isn't this wonderful? These tiny houses are being built. And I think there's a perception that dozens of tiny houses are being built at one time, when in fact it's one tiny house every 3 months.
Yes, she's probably got 4 to 5 at some point in the construction, but she's actually completing one about every 3 to 4 months.
Wow. And what are the prospects for you rebuilding?
Well, it's going to happen one way or another, sweetie. Time will make the difference. We have wonderful people like the Sioux Chi and the Mennonites that are definitely advocating to try to get us at least a little house, if not a kitchen. Do. But again, they're all donation. Everything they have is donation. They don't have deep pockets.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that the Sioux Chi are doing the paperwork and they've got just in Concow 40 cases of people that qualified, that actually had a house that lost a house. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Of those 40 people, then they've got to break down a need factor, family, medical, senior. They go through those 40, and then they take that they put together a case. They go sit down at what they call a round table, and they go through, say, 10 cases when they know they've only got 2 funds for 2 houses. Mm-hmm. So then they go through those 10 cases, and they decide on 2. Then the rest aren't just put in a circular file. The rest are then put back into their computer, and they wait until those 2 houses are done. Then they try to work on funding to do some more. You know, they finish the project, and then they do another. So the Mennonites do all of that. They build the houses, and all their labor's free. So what they have to do is get funding for the actual materials. And then they have to comply with the county, and they also are trying to make sure those materials are fire resistant, you know, so that when there's another fire, and there will be, you know, it may not be for 25 years, but there will be, that more of the homes will be able to survive so that there's not this kind of devastation.
Yeah.
So even that, you know, and that the Sioux Chi are just one of the ones that are long-term case managers is what they call them. There are a couple of other groups out there. I haven't heard too much about the other groups, what they've been able to actually accomplish.
And the Sioux Chi, they're just a volunteer program?
Yes, they are. They're Buddhist-based philosophy from Taiwan.
Mm.
And they're amazing people. I've been working with them since about 2 weeks after John and I got back up here, helping hook them up with people that weren't able to get to the FEMA,
mm-hmm.
or didn't have the proper paperwork or whatever the problem was. They came up here and started working with me to help them We've been working together ever since. Quite honestly, for me, I have no doubt that I will get a house at some point. Everybody else doesn't have that.
Yeah. You're still living in a travel trailer.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Terry, if there was one thing that you wanted people to know about recovery after the fire in terms of food and housing, anything like that, what would it be?
Be patient with us, because a lot of people think, oh, it's been 2 years. Everything should be fine. They don't need our help anymore.
Yeah.
And nothing could be farther from the truth.
Do you feel like you are and the community are in a better position today, or were in a better position a year ago?
That is a hard one, because honestly, I think it's probably a little bit worse situation, only because the reality that our help is not going to be there, that people were looking towards to kind of save them,
mm-hmm.
you know, so emotion wise and all of that, and a lot of that part of it is definitely worse now than it was a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
A year ago, people still had a lot of hope.
And today?
Well, today that hope has pretty much been yanked out from under them with what PG&E is doing. A year ago, they were promising, oh, we're going to replace everything, every dime. You know, now the reality of what is going on is coming to light, and people are going, oh my gosh, I'm only going to get a quarter of what I actually lost. And they're not even going to give it to me all at once so that I can try to move on with my life.
Mm-hmm.
They're nickel and diming us and really giving it to us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My husband, John's, you know, saying about how everything is so much more expensive than it was, you know.
Yeah.
What we're talking about is just a year ago, like I said, they were promising everybody the moon. And I kept trying to tell them, guys, don't bank on this, please. Now that they're actually getting the numbers, and they're still not wanting to give people how much they're actually getting, but they're making people relive this again.
Mm-hmm.
They want more detail. They want as much as of what they lost, what they went through. Yeah, and that's part of the big problem that people don't realize. It's not that we mind sharing our story. It's just that when our future is dependent on telling that story over and over and over again, how do people get better?
It's reliving the trauma.
Yep. And like I said, they've asked for details, you know, to the best of your ability. What did you have? What can you prove you had? Can you get people to sign affidavits? Most people did this. And you know what? Most of those papers that those people did have been lost. They're having to do it again. The PG&E attorneys are not accepting what people said at that point in time. They're having to tell those stories over. And then they're having to try and write it down, which I'll tell you true, I have not been able to do. I can think about what was in my home. The minute I try to stop and actually write it down, my brain goes dead. I cannot get it from my head to paper. So, like I said, so now you put on top of that the fact that we, not me personally, everybody, when I say we, a year ago, they were talking about, you know, rebuilding this and being able to replace that. And now they're going, I can't even buy my kids a Christmas present, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of where things are and why it's different.
Terry, thank you so much. You know, I'm trying to help my students understand the long-term recovery impacts of disasters of all kinds. And your knowledge is just invaluable. And so I really, really, really appreciate it.
Now that we've met Terry, let's change our focus a little bit and talk to Cheryl Lee Harrell. Cheryl Lee is a woman in her mid-60s who has lived up on the mountain for about 25 years now. Cheryl Lee was asleep on the morning of the fire when her son came in and told her that they needed to escape. Cheryl Lee can't drive due to physical limitations, and her son did not have a car. And so they ran out to the road and got a ride from a passing car and made their way down the mountain. Cheryl Lee came back in about 4 months after the fire, lived on Terry's property in a travel trailer, and then in summer of 2019, Cheryl Lee moved back to her property. She's been living there ever since by herself in a travel trailer with her dogs. She is in the process of being approved to have a house built for her on the site of her old home by volunteer organizations. Shirley is one of the many people in the burn scar who did not have insurance. She had lost her house about 10 years before the campfire in another fire. So she was unable to afford fire insurance. So she didn't have any insurance. Although she owned the property outright, Shirley has no money to rebuild. She lives solely on donations and on Social Security check that she gets every month. She does not get food stamps or any other assistance. Again, she has physical limitations. She's not able to drive, but she's lived on the mountain for 25 years. She raised her children there and then her grandchildren. Today, Shirley lives by herself on the mountain, about a half a mile from where Terry lives, which is fortuitous because it is Terry who provides most of her meals. Please welcome Shirley Harrell, who is not only someone who is a campfire survivor, she's a good friend and someone I've gotten to know really well over the past year and a half.
It's really cold here tonight.
Yeah.
I got the heaters going.
Do you have gas heat? Do you have gas heaters up there or do you have electric?
Propane heater that's separate from the trailer.
Mm.
Pond system.
Mm-hmm. Does that work pretty well?
Yeah, it really does. It heats the whole trailer up to 4 days on a 5 gallon tank.
Okay. Do you have it going all the time or just when you're awake?
Just when I'm awake and I'm up, like tonight before I go to bed and stuff, I'll turn it off. And then I'll go to bed. And of course, it's still warm in here for about an hour or two.
Mm-hmm.
By then, I'm asleep and I'm piled under blankets between me and all the dogs. We stay warm. I never go to bed without the dogs. I'm having to sleep on the couch area. And it folds down into a twin. And it's really funny because it's not long enough to stretch completely out.
Uh-huh.
So I sleep kind of curled up at night. But mm-hmm. but I've gotten used to it. Mm-hmm. So it mm-hmm. just falls a little shorter than what my body is.
Are you using the bed area in your trailer for storage?
Back into the trailer there, which I would love to be able to go stretch out in my bed, but it's all piled up with boxes and storage and everything else because I still haven't gotten a storage unit.
Yeah.
I did talk to Terry, and she is actually working on it right now. There's a group that's going to get me a storage unit, but she had to finish filling out the paperwork from that tonight, so it'll probably be a couple of weeks maybe. It's the Seventh-day Adventist.
Okay.
They're now saying that they will bring the trailer up. They will bring it up here.
Oh, nice.
Right. See, before, they wouldn't deliver the trailers up here. We would qualify for one, though, but we had to go get them ourselves. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to do that because they're pre-built. You know what I'm saying? So because of them being pre-built and stuff, you'd have to rent a truck. Some kind of special flatbed truck in order to fit it on there and be able to get it on there and off of there. They're saying that they'll deliver. So I'm like, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
So she put my name in for it. She finished up the paperwork today, so I'm sure they haven't gotten it yet, but I'm happy.
Hey, Shirley. I am, I'm teaching this sociology of disasters class, and we're talking about the campfire for a couple weeks, and we're specifically talking about recovery and food and housing security to try to understand some of the barriers that people face after a disaster in getting food and housing needs met. And so I'm just, we're 2 years out from the fire, and I'm just kind of wondering where you're at with being able to get food and housing.
Well, I'm getting food through Terry and then whatever I buy.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the only way that we're getting any food access up here in Concord.
How far is it to a real grocery store for you?
12 miles. It's from here down to right there by Terry's. From here all the way down to the dome store. Dome store is the nearest place to buy groceries. The prices there are like 4 times higher.
Yeah.
Than any place else, it seems. And the only other way to get groceries is to go all the way into Oroville or Chico.
How far is that?
It is from where I'm at. It's about 27 miles.
Mm-hmm. And the prices are better in town.
Yes.
And is the selection better in town too of groceries that you can get?
Well, yeah, because you got Food for Less and Food Max and all those. Whereas here in Concord, the only place you have to buy groceries. And it's really kind of a convenient thing. It's at the dump store.
Which is more like a convenience store than anything else, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
For instance, I like eating those breakfast bowls in the morning because they're easier for me.
Yeah.
Because my oven in the trailer doesn't work. But I have the stove top and I have a microwave. A breakfast bowl up here is $4 and something, whereas in town they're only $2 and something.
So it's double the price at the dome store.
Yes.
Yeah. And you're not able to use a stove or your oven. Are you able to use a stove top?
I can use the stove top. I just can't use the oven part. So that's why I never try to bake anything or, you know, stuff like that. It either has to be done in the microwave or it has to be done on the stove top.
What do you eat most days? What's your, you know, with kind of a limited access to food and limited cooking facilities, what is your typical day for food?
My typical day is I get up in the morning and I put a breakfast bowl in the microwave, you know, the breakfast bowls and stuff, and they have them in, you know, where you can have the eggs and potatoes, or I like the biscuit and gravy one.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to be my favorite of all of them.
And then what comes after that?
I don't know. Some days I'll go and I'll wait until dinner time.
Mm-hmm.
I usually am not really a lunch person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to be eating 4 and 5 small portions a day, mm-hmm. is what my doctor says.
Is that for health reasons?
Yes, because of the diabetes, blood sugars and stuff. And I take that pill that boosts my...
Your glucose?
Yeah, it's a pill that brings it up.
And your insulin?
So that when I eat, it... processes it faster.
Mm-hmm.
And I take the pills every morning, and then I go through the day until at night, and then at nighttime I take another pill, but it's for my blood pressure, because I do blood pressure medications twice a day.
And what's your normal dinner time look like?
Well, 3 days a week, Terry brings food out, which is cooked from Iams.
Mm-hmm. So it's a hot meal 3 days a week?
And then during the other 4 days a week, I either cook it on the stovetop, because I do have a full-size refrigerator now outside the trailer, and I built a tarp thing over the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps keep the rain and stuff off of it. So I have a full-size refrigerator, so that's been good, because that way I can do regular grocery shopping.
So you can go actually into town and get a couple weeks worth of groceries probably.
Right. Well, what I've been doing is going into town about every 2 months. And since I'm not cooking here every single night, then, like I said, 3 days a week I eat out at Terry's at Ike's.
Do you get, like, food stamps or anything like that to help you with your food costs?
No. The freezer, that was full of meats and everything else. And also my refrigerator in the house completely, well, it all burnt.
Mm-hmm.
So I lost all of my food at that time.
Mm-hmm. Because you had to evacuate during the bear fire in September. Right. And so they turned off the power. Mm-hmm. And so your food all went bad.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, are we talking about at the time of the wildfires?
The ones that just happened when you ended up in Willows in September, when you all had to evacuate.
Yes,
like it, yeah.
We had to evacuate out, and I lost all my food, my freezers and stuff, plus some stuff was stolen.
How long did that take you to recover from? Just you know, being evacuated for, because you had to find a hotel?
Right. Well, I spent the night in the car for 2 nights,
mm-hmm.
with my son's girlfriend and 2 kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually was sitting up in the back seat that whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ended up back over at the place that she lived over in another city. And I spent 2 nights there. And then they got me into the motel. They paid for 2 rooms.
And But how did you get food for those? I mean, and you didn't have any money for food. I remember while you were there.
I did, because I called you for pizza that one night.
Yeah. So, I mean, because it was...
They gave us sandwiches.
Yeah, but it took a couple days to do that. Like this, you know, you evacuate and then you're just kind of stuck on your own and, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, okay, well, you're supposed to, you know, they give you a voucher for a hotel, but then you're in a different city and right. you don't have any...
And that was the problem that we had is because I live here.
Right. Right.
And when they said they would give us vouchers, there were no motels available. I mean, nothing available. We called every motel, everything.
In Oroville or anything?
That was called around and got there. The ones who found the motel where we ended up at,
mm-hmm.
over mm-hmm. in Willows.
Mm-hmm. How long were you gone from your house that time?
I ended up being gone for like almost 9 days.
So tell me about...
You're not eligible for, FEMA, they gave me, they gave me back $400.
Mm-hmm. After you had gotten home.
Right, after right. I'd gotten home. Yeah. That was to help cover some of the, because when we were evacuated, okay, I only have my Social Security, and because we didn't get help right away... Okay, I had already spent most of my money on, paying my bills and stuff. So by the time we got evacuated out, by then all the bills and stuff had been paid, which didn't leave me much of anything to do anything with.
Right.
All my food and everything was already bought for here. So once I got out, there I sat with no money. Couldn't afford a motel for a night or anything like that. I had to wait until I could get assistance or find assistance to get any help.
Tell me where you're at with, you're living in a travel trailer on your property, and how long have you been living in Concow on your property?
Total since before the fires?
Yeah.
22 years.
22 years, and then 2 years since the fires. And right. your property was paid off, right?
It's completely paid off. Yeah. I owe nothing on the land or anything like that.
Your property was paid off, and you don't really have family around that you can rely on to live with. And so you went back after the fire, and now you've been living on your property in a travel trailer for almost 18 months now, something around there?
Well, yes.
What's the prospect for rebuilding?
Well, that's been a frustrating situation lately. I filed through the Tucci Foundation. They finally got me approved. So I was approved for them to come out, this other organization that will come out and rebuild my house. The frustration that we're running into is, okay, we look at the lawsuits, which they're now saying that it could be up to 2 years before we would get all the money that we're supposed to get. I'm right now pushing to get just $25,000 of that. And when I get that, all that goes to the Tucci Foundation. Okay, they're not charging me for labor. The house and all that will be done. There's this other group that's helping them, but they're going to do all the building for free.
So the labor to build the house for free.
But I have to pay for all the building supplies, okay. all the materials and stuff. And that's what I'm pushing on the lawsuits for right now.
Okay.
And yet the lawsuit people are telling me that there's no guarantee that I'll get $25,000. Okay, because first off, FEMA's going to take all their money back out of that lawsuit. They get paid first. Then the state gets all their money that they gave me.
So this is a recent, like, so the judge recently said PG&E needs to fork over some money up to $25,000 for survivors, correct?
Right.
That's the first payment, but before, right. but out of that 25, that initial 25,000, the first people that have to be paid back is FEMA. And how much money did you get from FEMA after the fire?
Well, I don't know how much FEMA will get out of this. I don't know how they're doing it. They're not communicating anything to us.
Yeah. So FEMA.
All. I mean, so from what I understand, they're supposed to send a straight 25,000.
But now you're hearing that FEMA is going to get a cut of it.
Well, FEMA, they're going to get their money, but it's coming out of the overall lawsuit. Yeah. So I'm not sure how much money I will end up with.
even out of this first 25,000.
This lawsuit, we may not, I may not, I may barely get enough just for the value of the house that I had. So if that's the case, it'd be 125,000 minus, you know, whatever FEMA takes and all of that. I have to come up with right now, $70,000 is what the Tucci Foundation, the people there, are supposed to get for just the building materials and stuff. And then the county will kick in $3,000 toward permits and that sort of thing. And then there's a $10,000 grant that they're trying to get me for building. So I'll be able to get that. So all together through donations, they should end up with about $35,000. And then the $70,000 that they get on a loan, some kind of loan they get, will pay for the rest of them, most of it. So they figure roughly it's going to cost around between $100,000 and $120,000 just in building materials.
To build your new house.
Everything is quadrupled since the fires.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first built the second part of the house, you figure 10 years ago, building materials, I mean, just all the permits and stuff like that only came up a little over $4,000. Now to rebuild the house, they're charging me, it's going to cost, with this house here, it's going to cost us close to $16,000 for building permits.
Wow.
They have more than quadrupled the price on building permits. So that's what's making it hard for a lot of people who are sitting there saying, okay, well, we can't afford to build.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, $16,000 is a lot of money just for the county to get permits.
And then the cost of building materials. Yeah, and then the cost of building materials in our area, because there's so much demand on them.
Right, is now quite more than quadruple. Yeah. So that's why it's going to cost around $120,000 just to buy the building materials.
Yeah.
Okay, so the lawsuit itself will be a combination of a lot of different things. I'm sure it would be more than just the value of the house, but I'm not going to see hardly any of that money because the state's going to get it. The county's going to get it.
Everyone's going to get their piece of the pie before you.
Right, before I see anything, if I even get anything cash-wise. I might be lucky just coming out of this with another house being rebuilt, and that's probably going to be the extent of it. And then, of course, FEMA's already, I mean, they're going to take their big hunk out of there. I would have never accepted the FEMA money if I had known that we had to pay it back. They didn't tell us that when the fires came through. We were not told at all that we had to repay FEMA back all their money. Nobody knew that. So here they are being evacuated out or kept out for over a year or two. And we got to give every dime of that money back now. FEMA never did that before. They should have been up front. It should have been up front with everybody so that they could have had a choice. If they at least could choose whether they would take their FEMA money or not. But nobody was told anything until after it was all said and done. And of course, like with me, being on Social Security, I used the money to put my well back in, my septic back in. Now I got to pay it all back.
Right.
So it's just crazy. A lot of people felt lied to and deceived.
Oh, they felt lied to and deceived. Okay.
But because the state and the counties were not up front with people, giving them a choice. You know what I mean? And now that the lawsuits are coming through and that's being settled, now it's like, you're not just going to get the money that you get from the lawsuit. It's going to be controlled by the state and the government.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll come in and they'll, you know, like they'll build my house, but they're not just going to give me the money to do whatever I choose to do with it.
Shirley, what's your biggest concern? What's your, you know, your number one problem right at this moment?
Frustration with the county and getting things done so that the house can be built.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really kind of caught in the bind right now, and I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
The Tucci Foundation told me that they were going to be, the people that actually do the building, were going to start on the first week of January. to rebuild the house. But they can't rebuild the house because of all the dead burnt trees that are still on the property. And then a month ago, I was told by the county that I was the second one in line for having the trees taken down. The Fire Safety Council, up here, said that they were going to come out and they were going to cut down the trees. Now, this was a month ago. They told me I was the second one on the list and that it would probably be out here within a week or two to get it done. Well, they've never showed up to do it. Meantime, another group came through. I don't know who they are. And he came out here, looked at all the dead trees and stuff, and said, and there's these blue dots that the county has put on there, dead trees.
Yeah.
And they tell me, well, it looks like the county are going to take down the trees. So, you know, we're probably not going to come in and do it now because the county's already picked for doing it. Well, then I try to get a hold of the Fire Safety Council to find out from them when they're going to be out here, being said I was the second person, you know, next in line to get it done. And they're not returning any of my phone calls now. I've tried for almost a month now to get a hold of them, and they have not returned not one of my phone calls.
Yeah.
So I have no clue when they're going to come out here and get these dead trees down.
Mm.
And because I don't know, I can't tell the 2T Foundation who's lined it up for the house to be rebuilt. Okay, so I don't know what to do. I'm kind of caught between a rock and a hard spot, and there's no communication with me.
Right.
So I'm just sitting here not knowing what's going to happen. I'm supposed to get this house started the first week of January, and like I said, I can't tell them anything because I don't know when they're going to cut the trees down, because the tree people of two different organizations, neither one of them are returning not one of my phone calls. So I don't know what to tell them.
And so that's holding up your housing.
Well, and I'm supposed to move, my trailer is sitting where the house is going to be built.
Yep.
I got to move my trailer to the other side of the property. Pushes you almost to that point where you think you're going to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're, I mean, what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I mean, I can't fight the county. I can't fight the state. I can't be homeless. I don't know where I would go. And I can't afford to rent anywhere because my Social Security is not enough to rent a place.
Yeah.
And because I own land, I can't get low income housing. I think they might make an adjustment thing there. I'm not sure. But what am I supposed to do? I just talked to a lady the other day that's been living on their property all these years, not bothered by anybody, but the county's going to come in and not allow people to live in an RV on their own land. We're going to be forced off the properties. And if they don't get off their properties, then they get fined. And then when the fine amount reaches the property value amount, the county then takes your land. So that's what people are being pushed up against.
So what do we learn today about recovery after a natural disaster? Number one, this recovery process goes on and on and on, especially for an event as widespread and catastrophic as the Camp Fire. It really is, you know, Hurricane Katrina-esque in the scope and the devastation that happened to the area. And that means that it takes a longer time to rebuild because not only, you know, if it's just one house that is destroyed in a fire, then the community can come around and they can help and they can do barn raising and, you know, they'll flood the homeowners with donations. But when it is 14,000 homes that need to be rebuilt, everything from the price of lumber increases to the price of housing increases because there's such shortage in housing. One of the things that we're really seeing 2 years after the fire now is that there is an issue happening, and this happened probably a year after the fire, but you know, it's really ongoing right now, is that there is some fatigue of the people who make donations to Camp Fire survivors. Number one, it's because, you know, there was so much help needed. But number two, you know, so many people needed assistance and went to local grocery stores and corporations and businesses that those people just got kind of tapped out. And now we're seeing 9 months into the COVID-19 pandemic that there is this, you know, trauma upon trauma, and so many people without work, so many people who are unsheltered today compared to even a year ago, that there is fatigue happening in the community for people who are the helpers. So we're seeing that it's placing people like Cheryl Lee in a more precarious position than they were even a year after the campfire. Couple that with these new fires that have happened over the past 6 months in California. 2019 was a really quiet fire year. 2020, not so much. And in fact, in neighboring Berry Creek, that is just a few miles away from Concow, a few miles as the crow flies, I should say, there was a devastating fire that displaced about 1,000 people and killed 15 people in Berry Creek. And so those people, right, this community that was already tapped out is now tapped out again and again and again with COVID-19, with more fires, with a recession that's happening in the global economy. And so it's making it so campfire survivors are, you know, getting hit again and again and again. And we see that, right? Cheryl Lee spent 9 days displaced from her home, evacuated because of the Berry Creek fires this year. And so this woman who was already kind of precariously perched economically was thrust literally within minutes into an evacuation setting and had no place to go. And then when she finally did find a place to go, had no food once she got there. All of her food was ruined after she got back because the power had been turned off. So all the food that she had stored up was ruined because the power was turned off. And it just put her back again to a very desperate situation. This is, you know, an ongoing thing. And in fact, doing this podcast and doing these interviews with Cheryl Lee and Terry made me realize that I need to go back and do more research. Again, this was just interviews with some people that I know who are campfire survivors. I wanted to know exactly what their food and housing situation was, what barriers they're having to get housing and to get food today. And I hope we did that in this podcast. In the meantime, I hope you learned a little bit. I hope you were able to appreciate the voices that we heard today. And I hope this puts a new perspective on long-term recovery after a natural disaster. I'm Marianne Paiva. Until next time, stay safe, take care of yourself, be well, and remember, sociology matters.